Whatever you should put it right there is fine.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Jai Ma, Jai Ma. We're inside today. It's a little cold and windy. And there's a helicopter, I think a rescue mission, something in the canyon. There's lots of helicopter work, so something's going on. I don't know. Often when that happened, there's some, maybe a cyclist fell off a road or something. I don't know. We'll hear about it tomorrow. But it's cold and windy, so we thought I'd come inside. You can see definitely it's falls here, you know, it's this cool wind that's come in, just signaling a Navaratri festival, the fall festival of the Divine Mother, which will start, today is Saturday, so Monday here is Mahalaya Amavasya. This is called Shraddh Paksha or Mahalaya Paksha. From last Purnima to today, till Monday is the 2 weeks, it's called Shraddh Paksha. This is a 2 week period. There were especially people do offerings for their ancestors, those who passed away. Like if you know the tithi when an ancestor has passed, like your mother or grandfather, somebody passed away, let's say they left their body on the third of the moon cycle. So during this period, on the third day of the moon cycle, one does Shraddh for them, the offerings of food and water and like that. And then on Mahalaya, the Amavasya, it's where it peaks. And it says that the world, the living, the world of the dead pass very near. They pass right next to each other, right? This is this time. So it's an opportunity to honor and feed and worship and sustain, even if we don't know the dates and we don't remember the names of our ancestors and family. Right, it's an opportunity. So people make offerings to all their ancestors. Anybody remembered or not remembered. It's believed that we do generally for 10 generations. We're responsible to do these ceremonies for 10 generations. And 10 generation means roughly 1,000 years. Right, roughly. That's the way it's figured out. And 1,000 years, usually it's figured by 1,000 years, roughly 1,000 years, the person has taken rebirth. This is the traditional one. Now we think, oh, I remember my past life, and you know, we're maybe the idea before is that to be reborn, well, the karmas, good and bad, have to be experienced in the world after death, right? And then the right body for your karmas to fructify in the next life will have to be arranged, and that's not easy, especially if you're a spiritual person. It takes a long time to find the exact. Krishna says in the Gita that the exact birth where a devotee will continue his or her practice, the right family, right situation, right education, right, everything has to be set up. And so it says it's not that easy. I remember one person sitting here years ago when we asked, no hard evidence for this, right? But we hear that people are reincarnated after a few years. And he says, yeah, nowadays for a worldly body and mind is there a dime a dozen. We don't need much, right? If you just need another worldly body and mind to incarnate in, those are easy to get, right? So, but to a spiritual body, a right situation may take some arrangement, right? So we take care, we feed and honor 10 generations. The idea is that in those, for that 1,000 years, the soul is in other worlds before taking rebirth. And it's believed that when you feed the souls during this time, one day, at least one day a year, with water and food, we use special tech called pindas, made of rice balls and sesame seeds and offerings of water. Traditional Hindu, there's other ways of doing it, but this is the traditional Hindu way, is that they have food and water for the year, right? So a year, so we do it one day. Right, but our one-day offering in the divine world, a year is 100 years. So we do one day, lasts a whole year. This is the way the math, the exponential math works, right? And so wherever they are, if they're in heaven, they're eating nice and drinking nicely. If they're in hell, they get water and they get a little bit of sustenance. If they've been reborn, they have food that year, right? What if they're born as a dog, right? The dog is well fed. Right. If nobody's doing, maybe there'll be a dog that's not fed. You know, this is the idea. We feel whatever, even if they've been reborn, it's still our duty. We have karmic connection to them. So we, I'm not saying your ancestors have been born as dogs. I'm not saying that either. I'm not saying that. But if they are, maybe they'd be born in a family where they're a good American dog gets fed very nicely. See, in the rest of the world, a dog's life can be a dog's life, you know. It's considered a punishment. I think in the West, it's like a auspicious birth. It gets very nice. Can be. I mean, there's suffering everywhere, but, you know. I remember one devotee, there was a wonderful, eccentric and wonderful Italian sadvi living in Rishikesh named Mother Luisa, disciple Swami Chidananda. And she took she you know, stray dogs found her because she's an animal lover, and she'd take care of them and feed them and rice and milk and all this type of stuff, right? And when one of the Swamis at Shivananda Ashram said, "Although I know this is against the scriptures, but I hope when I die, I'm born as a dog taken care of by Mother Luisa." Because it's like the best possible arrangement. It's like, these are beautifully taken care of dogs, you know. But whatever situation, we've broken, we don't have the connection to our ancestors. May I mention this before recently that, you know, you ask, you know, what's your grandfather's name, or your great-grandfather's name, or great-grandmother's name? A lot of us don't know. Right, you know, it's like we don't even remember our great-grandparents' names, right? And there's a mantra, there's a Swami from Bharatseva Ashram, he was explaining during the Achaman and during part of the puja where you sprinkle using two different fingers and they represent different planets. He says this is to increase fame. And so he says, but that's the weird thing in doing puja, we shouldn't be trying to increase fame. Name and fame is usually considered a hindrance. He says, no, it's not like that. We shouldn't name and fame. Desire for name and fame is an ego thing. That's very hard to get overcome. Right. What that means is that we should do something that people remember us. We should live a valuable life. And then he used that same example. He says, I did a shraddh for somebody whose father died, and I asked, what's your great-grandfather's name? For the mantras, he wanted to invoke and make offerings for 3-4 generations. And he didn't know. Right. That really struck me, that within three generations, nobody remembers their name. Their own grandchildren don't know their names. Right. So, you know, so we should live a type of life that makes people, at least our own family should remember our name, if not society, you know. Look at, our Guruji used to say, you know, Jesus, one man born in a poor family, right, in a socially neglected part of society, right, then he also dies, he's executed as a criminal, and 2,000 years later people still remember him. Right, you know, that these people, some people have their lives are so significant, generation, that ages remember them. You know, that's not that we need ages to remember us, but at least our children should remember us, our grandchildren should remember us. So it's a very important that this Krishna Paksha, I mean this Shrad Paksha and Mahalaya Amavasya, it's very auspicious. Actually, every Amavasya is good to do ancestral worship. This one is the most important, coming up on Monday for this worship. What we'll do at the end of the puja, we'll offer, we make pindas, and we also, the plate of prasad is offered in the name of everybody. Everybody brings, it's said, a very beautiful image. You imagine them line, like when we do a bandara, when people line up in rows to be fed, you say that the ancestors, all of our generations, line up in rows to accept our food on this day. Right, that's an opportunity. It's interesting, it's always around the same season as Halloween, and therefore the Day of the Dead, which is another major world culture doing a very similar thing of feeding and honoring and remembering their ancestors. By all things, I also think, just on a psychological level, I think it's significant because this is part of our past, our biological and emotional past and our family and all those beauties and complications of it all. And before that has to be, in a certain, you have to do our duty to that and clean it all up and do proper offerings for that. And then the Navaratri starts, this worship, this invocation of the great goddess, you know. I think it's part of the cleaning process. It's like we're cleaning right now, deep cleaning of the temple. And that's a big thing you should, if you haven't started, you have 3 days to deeply clean your house. Right? You have to think if your mom's coming over, right, you know, what to speak of the Divine Mother coming over. Last year, I think, we were joking on this similar talk. He's like, and even if like a judgy high school friend comes over, you clean up. Somebody's like, oh my God, I gotta judge, you know, feel like you, how much, just for that you clean up, you know. But if you're invoking the Divine Mother, Divine Shakti of the universe, not only symbolically make everything beautiful for her, but also that Shakti, if it's not clean, like before, like we've also, we're required and we do, we clean our river, our the river out here right before flood season. A lot of water may be coming. You better nothing meant and should be we should be the way should become clear. Otherwise it is dangerous, right? So when you invoke this Maha Shakti Parashakti, the way has to become clean. So we clean inside, we clean outside, we clean our past through this Shatpaksha pujas, like that. So then Navaratri starts, and then that will still from Tuesday. In America it's from Tuesday on. In India it's from Wednesday. They're the way their calendar titis of this works out. And Amavasya is on Monday. That's called Somavati Amavasya, very auspicious. And Amavasya is on a Monday. Somavati Amavasya, it's a very special for Shiva also. Shiva and Shakti together. And also very auspicious for the Shradpaksha. So it's considered very auspicious. And then Navaratri started on Tuesday, which is a Devi day. It's a very significant program. So anyways, we're continuing our talks on the Kali Puja, the introduction to the Kali Puja, Nitya Kali Puja. Can you grab me the puja book, the small puja book? Where we are last week, we did the Devata Puja and Mandir Devata Puja, the deities on the shrine, the deities that are worshipped in the home, and the cluster of deities. We went through the ones that are worshipped here, and those principles, and a little bit discussing those. Thank you. I think we may have forgotten a few. We went through all the different deities that we worship, and we include in our daily worship here, in special worship. And so now the next section in the puja, it's called Baneshwar Puja. I got the right page, and I lost it. Baneshwara. So I'm not sure if Baneshwara Puja is universally practiced. Well, this is a very tantric detail. And especially in the Bengali manuals, ritual manuals, it's always there. And Baneshwara is the worship. It's a form of Shiva. I'll recite his Dhyan mantra, give you his description. It's a classical form of Shiva, very beautiful. But especially Bana is also the Shiva Lingam, especially from the Narmada, river. All the stones from the Narmada river are called Bana Lingams. Actually, every stone, the whole riverbed is considered a form of Shiva, and every stone is a form of it. And so the ones that are found automatically in the river, and there's one area near Jabalpur, I've never been to this particular area, but that their traditional families dive and get these stones. And they should be automatically, they're not carved, they're found already that shape. Most of the time when you buy a Narmada Shivalingam, they're very beautiful markings. We have so many here. Most likely, they've been taken from the river. You can tell they're from the right river, so they're considered Shiva. But they've been shaped, right, more or less. Most likely, they've been carved by machine and things like that. There's shops in Jabalpur and like that, where these monolingams are made. But if you can find them from this particular place, already shaped, that's considered most auspicious. They're also called Swayambhu. Swayambhu means self-manifested. They automatically came. They weren't carved. You can carve, or it can be... You found this automatically this way. A Swayambhu Shivalingam from Narmada. This is from this place in Narmada. So that's officially Baneshwar Lingam or Narmada Lingam. There's another type of Shivalingam, they call them, I think, the Shaila Lingam. Shaila means stone. So it means any other, outside we have a beautiful Shivalingam under the tree named Baba Dakshineshwar Mahadev. That was hand carved by one of our devotees and installed. Right, Prana Pratisthana was done. Many 12 years ago or something, 12, 13 years ago. This on? I don't even know if the microphone's on. Okay, I'm not sure. I think I'm talking quieter and quieter, but I don't know if it's my fault or microphone's fault. I may not have much voice, that's why I have to... Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's just Shivalingam made of stone. Right, Shaila Lingam, they call them, or the first Navarat, the first deity of the Navadurga is Shailaputri, she who is born from the stone, means from the Himalayas, right? So Shaila means stone, it means mountain. So that's a purposely carved any stone shaped like a Shivalingam, or it can also be out of clay, or mud, or Ganga mud, and things like that, Shivalingams. And those have their, and each type, the scriptures also mention different lingams have different type of benefits of their worship. We talked last week or 2 weeks ago, we're not overly concerned about benefits, right? We worship out of devotion and we get infinite benefit. If you worship for a benefit, you if you get a benefit, you only get that benefit, not the full not the full not the full result. But then there's so that the, and so you can also take a regular stone and carve a Bunalingam out of it. So it's shaped like a Bunalingam, like that egg or the but it's not really a Bunalingam because it's not from, it's not naturally formed from the Narmada River, taken from particular kund, right, or it's particular ghat, right? So it's not, but still, you know, we have, you'll see, we have and if you've seen, there's some out of crystal, there's some out of jade, there's some out of all kinds of different types of stone that can be done. Spatiklingam, a crystal lingam, is also very auspicious. It says that even to see a crystal, we have any, we have the main one there, but if you see a crystal shivalingam, so we'll have to see whether or not, how auspicious, what your past life karmas are. To see a crystal shivalingam requires 100 lives of auspicious karmas in the scriptures. So the fact that we have them here, and we'll see whether or not you've ever seen it, if you've ever noticed them, what your past karmas are. It could be our test. I don't know. I can't see your past life, but I'll let you see. Tell me if you can find a crystal shivalingam in the house, and then I'll we actually have one on the shrine right now. No, several, I think. But these are also hand carved. But sometimes we worship them as Bunalingams. But our actual Bunalingam should be from this river, right? And so in the, I quoted it last week or 2 weeks ago, in the maybe Kulanavara Tantra, one of these late tantras, it mentions that where unless a Bunalingam is present during the puja, right, the worship of Kali, Tada, and Sodashi, something like that, cannot be performed, right? Won't be. So tantras make big thing. Unless you do this, nothing will work. I'm not quite sure if you're worshiping your puja at home and you don't have a Bunalingam, it's not that your mantras have had no power and your puja has had nothing. But this is the tantric way and the Puranic way to say this is a good thing. It's a way of emphasizing, right, the worship, that they should be present. And the way often we use the Bunalingam is we use it, can't say in place of the deity, but as a placeholder for the deity. Like if you have the Kali Murti here, and then we all have the ghat, the water pot, that's considered to be the embodiment of the deity. And then usually in the offering bowl, we'll place a Bunalingam. We'll take the Bunalingam from the shrine and put it there. And so all the bathing we do like we don't bathe our deity regularly. You know, there's some deities that can be easily bathed. But this deity, the way she is and her size and the way she's dressed, it takes a whole afternoon to clean, to dress her and bathe her and redress her, and her clothes are sewn onto her. And so it's actually a complicated thing. But we bathe her every day, but we don't bathe the Murti every day. We wipe her clean every day, right? We bathe her through the Shivalingam, right? So the same mantras, we imagine like we take the conch full of water, and just like we imagine bathing the deity, we're bathing the Shivalingam. That the lingam takes on, is a placeholder, or you can worship everyone. The way it was explained to me when we started this many years ago, almost 25 years ago, when pujas first began to describe, was taught to us that this is just that you can worship everyone in. And it was said that Baneshwara means Lord of the Universe. I'm not exactly sure if that's actually what it means, Bana, as far as the root of the word. I have a feeling, what I understand, it actually means like a Bana. Bana is almost like a body, like a, not a port, but some water jetty or some inundation, something like a port or a bay or something like that. So something associated with rivers and bodies of water, Bana probably means that, right? But it was explained, Bana means universe, universal. And therefore, he's the Lord of the Universe. And then for Shiva, Lord Shiva is the Lord of the Universe, right? But he's also universal, means you can worship, like we say, universal coverage, means it's everywhere, you know? So it's like, I mean, you can worship anybody in the Bunalingam. Like, so that you can do Guru Puja to the Bunalingam. You can do Ganesh Puja to the Bunalingam. Shiva Puja, of course, to the Bunalingam. Devi Puja, Ramakrishna Puja, Hanuman Puja. Everybody can be worshipped in the Baneshwar, in the Bunalingam, okay? So if you have, the way the most of the puja books will word it, if Bunalingam is present, then this part of the puja should be done. So if Bunalingam is present, this puja should be done. We take the Bunalingam, and it's just like the regular Shiva puja, there's a dhyan mantra, right? We do a dhyan mantra, we do the five item worship, and a pranam mantra. Same setup, but it's very interesting. Also something I'm researching, but it's not easy to research because I don't know who to ask. But in this book, in the Ramakrishna Puja book, which is where we pulled this mantra from, he uses the Bija mantra Aim for Baneshwara. And Aim is the Vak Bija mantra, Saraswati Bija mantra, and Guru Bija mantra. It's not associated with any. I don't know any other mantra for Shiva where the Aim Bija mantra is used, right? So I have a feeling, this is what I have to ask. I wish I would have found this out before this class because then I could give a definitive answer for it. But I have to ask. It's not easy to find the right person to ask this. Because everybody I've asked says, well, the book says Aim, right? So why did the book say Aim? Because it's used, since you're worshipping the main deity in the lingam, right? I think you use the Bija mantra of the main deity for Shiva. And this is a Ramakrishna Puja book. The Bija mantra is Aim for Ramakrishna, right? So I'm wondering, so if we're doing Kali Puja, should we use Kring? That's a question, or instead of Aim. So that I haven't got the answer for. We'll have to get the answer. So here it says Om Aim, right? Or Om Kring. Prammatam Shakti Samyuktam Banakyam Mahaprabham Kama Bhanavitam Devam Samsarada Dehana Kshamam Shingarari Rasolasam Banakyam Parameshwaram. This is the Dhyan mantra. Pramatam, he's completely intoxicated. So this form of Shiva, actually the Shiva is, because usually we meditate upon, of course we meditate on the form of Shivalingam, but it's the Shiva that's in union with Shakti, right? So he's intoxicated, but he's intoxicated with divine bliss of union. Pramatam Shakti Samyuktam. Actually it says, perfect, Pramaptam, intoxicated, Shakti Samyuktam, because of his union with Shakti. Right, so this is often we see, actually in Hinduism it's not as common. Actually, the very symbol of Shiva Lingam and the Yoni could be in ancient times could have been interpreted this way. That's not the normal way of thinking of it. But usually we think in Buddhism we see these form where you have like the Buddha and in sexual embraces the Shakti, right? That's a common thing, right? Whether the Devi that he's embracing, and in Tibetan Buddhism they give a particular interpretation. This is wisdom and the Shakti of the deity is turned. Normally our Shakti goes out, our power goes out, right? But when the image is turned around and embraced, right, the image is sexual and erotic, right? But the image of that the Shakti being absorbed rather than spread out, in union with Shakti rather than spreading. So now that I'm looking out, but this would be looking in. I'm listening out, this is listening in. All the energy that goes out when the energy has gone in, that creates Pramata, divine intoxication. Intoxicated because he's in union with his Shakti. Banakya Mahaprabham. Lord Bana. Mahaprabham, who shines with divinity. Mahaprabham, who's greatly shining. Right? Kama Bhanavitam Devam. So he's destroyer of Kamadev. Right, so we know this is a typical name for Shiva. Shiva in the stories, when Kamadev, actually it's interesting, because Kama in the story, Shiva, there was a demon, I think Tarakasura, no? Tarakasura was needed. He had a boon from Brahma that only the legitimate born son of Shiva can kill him. So of course Shiva at that time, had no wife. Right, he had no Sati had died, and he was in he was deep meditation. He had no wife and no interest in another wife, right? And therefore he had no son, and therefore it's like saying you'll be killed by the son of a barren woman type thing. It's like a non-existent being, right? So the Tarakasura thought he was quite safe. He'd be built by the legitimate son of Shiva. Shiva has no wife and will never take a wife, and therefore can have no son, and therefore can never be killed, right? But then the gods, realizing that something has to happen, so they arrange for by their prayers and divine arrangement, Parashakti, the Shakti of Shiva, is reborn as Parvati, then they have to get Shiva out of meditation to be interested in Parvati. She's doing austerity, but they also have to awaken Parvati, Shiva's mind. So they send Kama. Kama is Cupid, right, in the Western system. And he has a very difficult job to agitate the mind of a yogi, right? Nowadays, not that hard to agitate the mind of yogis, but at one time, it meant something when your yogis' minds were... By definition, a yogi's mind is one whose chitta is unmoving, right? We use a word now, unless you have the bare minimum of chitta nirodha, you're not a yogi by Patanjali's definition, right? Or at least trying for it. Now we don't even try for it and use the word, but to speak about the attaining that state. So Shiva is in completely ignoring. He's in self-absorbed, not interested. His shakti is actually interesting. His shakti is not outside. It's entirely inside, right? So he has to awaken kama in him. What is it? Desire is for an outside shakti. Where you desire something outside, not from within. So he goes and starts shooting. He shoots. In the best telling of this, if you want to read a really dramatic and fascinating telling, this is from Tulsidas. Tulsidas is reminded the details of when what happened in nature. I mean, it was quite a response when in order to awaken lust in Shiva. So he pulls all of his skill, all of his charm, all of his beauty, all of excitement, enticement, and sensation, and shoots the arrow into the heart of Lord Shiva, who's meditating. And deep in meditation, he says he feels a little tiny, some little disturbance. He says, "What could be disturbing me? I'm lost in meditation, right? I'm not interested in anything, right?" And he opens his eyes and he sees still the smoking spear, you know. They do. The smoking spear in Kamadev's hand, right? And he says, "Oh, how dare!" And he says he just opens his third eye and goes, "Hum," and a shaft of a lightning bolt or shaft of light or something, and burns Kamadev. And he closes his eyes. So that didn't work out the way we thought, right? So that's generally the way the story. So he's known as the destroyer of Kamadev, or the burner of Kamadev, the burner of Cupid, right? As this is Navaratri, we have to understand that in the Devi tradition, the story continues in a different way. In the Devi tradition, it says that Kamadev's wife, Rati, right? Kama means lust, Rati means the joy of union, right? His Rati was, oh my God, her husband has just been burnt to ash, right? This is not his fault. This was his job. The gods pushed him. He's been burnt to ashes. And so she collects the ashes and puts them together, right? And makes a little man, a shape of her husband. And he comes alive, right? But now this is the ashes. Lust is difficult enough, but actually lust is required. Without desire, there'd be no expression in life. There'd be no children, no next generation, no work, no karma, no, you know, all the things that make life work requires it, right? No art, no joy, no pleasure, no ice cream, you know, like all the things that have some, they have a limited importance. Without it, would be difficult. But difficult, right? Lust is definitely a botheration, right? But without it, it's a bigger botheration, unless you're completely lost, like Shiva, in meditation. But most of us, you know, what happens? So he creates a pile of ashes, creates a new kama, right? This is the shadow of lust. This is not the original thing. This is something more twisted, more unregenerate. I don't know how to describe it. Hidden. I mean, Freud and Jung can argue on their side what this means, right? But along those lines, it's perfect and like that. And he comes alive. When he comes alive, all the gods, all the sages, all the men, and all demons scream, "Stop!" Because he's so horrifying, right? And stop means bund, right? Bandhasura. He used to stop a demon, right? Because he's much worse than Kamadev ever was, you know? So anyways, it's hard to kill a shadowy person, right? And so eventually, Lalita Tripurasundari is invoked in order to kill Bandhasura. That's her main creation story or source story. The gods do a fire sacrifice. She comes out of the Shriyantra in the fire, and then she eventually kills Bandhasura. Very beautiful story. But anyway, so this is Kama Banavitam Devam, destroyer of Kama. Samsara dahana kshamam. This is he bearing the burning of the samsara, all the suffering and burning of the material world, the world of birth and death or the manifested world, he bears all this burning. He's the support of this, or he absorbs it. Right. But anyway, one of the points was that well, we can think, oh, this is Shiva in union with Parvati, right? And in blissful union with Parvati. But actually, he's the story of Kama, right? So this is Shiva, actually. So the union with Parvati is necessarily the Mr. and Mrs. God, the way you think of Shiva and Parvati and their you know, like the Mr. and Mrs. God version of Shiva and Parvati, right? The Purana is like, this is a very different, this is Shiva in meditation is in union with Shakti. Not, you know, it's a different type of union. There's an external union where the poles of opposites that make creation. And there's the internal union where one just becomes an internal bliss, not an external bliss, right? This is his mood. Kama maritam devam samsara dahana dehana kshamam shingarari rasolasam. He is the manifestation of the aesthetic sentiments. So this is the here it says Sringaradi. I mean, beginning with, so the eight sentiments is in Indian poetics and in aesthetic theory, there's different pleasurable sentiments. And he says beginning with the erotic, right? So first is this romantic or the erotic, but then you have like being rejected, right, or rejecting somebody. You know, it's like if you do a lot of watching of Indian devotional mythological shows like Devaki Dev Mahadev and the Mahabharata and like that, and you see every time somebody says something, the camera goes to like the six people, and each one has all these different. It's strange for us because what they're doing. This is the tradition of, this is the way things are done on stage. Each expression, a dancer learns, and actors learn these things. Each expression shows a different bhava. Right, one's of shock, one's of intrigue, one's of, you know, one's, you know, it's like you see paintings of Radha where she's pushing Krishna, or like Krishna's trying to get her attention, she's like annoyed with him, right? But that annoying with him is very attractive, is attracting him. She's not actually annoyed with him. The annoyed with him is, you know, these are, I mean, these get diluted and stepped down in our human relationships. We're being annoyed with each other, actually is being annoyed with each other. Not being annoyance is an attraction, you know. So he's the embodiment of all these aesthetic, all these pleasurable, aesthetic, beautiful sentiments, right? Beginning with the erotic, because he's the essence of the erotic is actually in union with his own Shakti, right? It's a very different conception. Banakyam Parameshwaram. Rasolasam Banakyam Parameshwaram. We, on you, Banakyam, O Lord Baneshwara, right, the supreme Lord, we meditate. So this is the Dhyan mantra, and then the item. Then he's the Shivaling. If a Shivalingam is there, he's bathed with Trayambakam Nijamahi. We mentioned this Mahamritanjaya mantra, ringing the bell like that, and then items: scent, flower, perfume, leaf, incense, light, food. The five item worship is done. And here also we use the Bij mantra. That's why I'm curious about the Bij mantra. Om Aim Baneshwara Shivaya Namaha. Previously it was Om Namah Shivaya. Here, Baneshwara Shivaya. So it's not just Shiva, it's specifically this Baneshwara Shiva. Baneshwara Shivaya Namaha. It was Aim or other Bijantra. And then the Gauri Pitam, the Shiva stand, is worshipped as Om Hrim Gauriyai Namaha, just like the Shiva Puja, where Devi is worshipped. And then his Pranam mantra is also very beautiful. Om Baneshwaraya Narakarnavataraya Gyana Pradaya Karuna Maya Sagaraya Kapura Kunda Devalindu Jatadharaya Darija Dukkha Dahanaya Namashivaya, something like that. Baneshwaraya, O Lord Baneshwara, Narakarnavataraya. He's the one that helps us cross this ocean, I translated as ocean of suffering, it's ocean of hell, right? You know, this hellish ocean of the world, he's the bridge who crosses, he's the Tirtha, he's the bridge that helps us cross over this world of the suffering, ocean of suffering. Jnana Pradaya, he's the giver, Prada, of Jnana, the giver of knowledge, wisdom, liberating wisdom. Karuna Maya Sagaraya, he is Sagara, he's an ocean, full of karuna, means full of mercy, or compassion, ocean of compassion, the beautiful epithet, ocean of compassion, ocean of mercy, giver of knowledge, the means of crossing the ocean of suffering, the giver of the knowledge of knowledge, and the ocean of compassion. Interesting. He helps us cross the ocean of suffering, the hellish ocean, but he himself is an ocean of compassion. Right? Kapura Kunda Davalindu. Kapura means camphor, kapur, right? So he is a color of camphor. What's that? Kapura, goram, what's the month? You know this. So even there, kapura goram, he is a color of white as camphor, right? Karuna avatar, the ocean, the incarnation of mercy. It's almost the same point, right? So he is described as white. And of course, we may have mentioned this before, but it's worth re-mentioning because it's cool. In the we always think of Shiva as color. He's a color of white, or he's a color of camphor, right? And the reason he's color of camphor, because he wears ash. He's covered in ash, actually. So if I'm covered in ash, Swami's white. The white is ash, or white is camphor, or white is, you know, white is jasmine. You give some simile, yeah. Literally white as ash. But actually, I'm not really white as ash, right? I don't know what color this is. It's not, definitely not white. The whitest person isn't that white, you know. Yeah, we're kind of pinkish, and, you know, I don't know what color. You know, depends if I've been in the sun a little bit and how you feel. So Shiva is actually not white. Do you remember what color Shiva is? You know.
Gray.
Crystal.
He's clear as crystal. Right, so that's why the crystal Shivalingam is so significant. In the Kalika Purana, which is the Stala Purana of the Kamakya temple, but it's an important text. And when I first got it, I was all excited. Oh, Kalika Purana is about Kali. You expect Kali like this Kali. Actually, it's a story of Shiva and Parvati. Right. But Parvati's name is also Kali because Parvati is dark, right, originally. And then due to some Leela, she did some tapasya and entered a river and came out as Mahagauri. Actually, in the Navadurga, Mahagauri, that story from Mahagauri, is then she came out white or light or golden, right? She changed colors. And the Chandi, she starts out Gauri, and she gets angry and becomes dark, becomes known as Kali, right? So these are different, the color represents a different mood, right? So Kalika here means Parvati, before she turned Gauri, before she turned golden. And Shiva, many of the gods have many wives in the stories, right? Even Ganesh, who has no wives, is also worshipped as two wives, right? But Shiva is never only has one wife. He has this ekt patni vratam, right? He's vowed to Parvati that he'll never take a second wife, right? And so that's the deal, right? Now it's the law, but this was the original deal, and so one time in their romantic interlude, he was sweating a little bit, and a little bit of the ash from his chest was washed away, and she saw reflected in his crystal-like chest, because his body is actually clear as crystal, means pure consciousness, right? She sees reflected her face. Yeah. Like, what? Another woman in your heart? I thought I was the only woman in your heart, right? And she furious and go. I mean, the whole Leela that's very interestingly told in the Kalika Purana, volume 2. We have a 2-volume version of it. I remember, right? If you're looking for it, and so that's also interesting because Parvati herself is only a reflection of Shiva. This is a Prakashan Vimarsha conception. We talked about that, but once you have two, you're gonna have. Once you get a mirror, then you have, imagine two mirrors. It starts, you know, you put two, and pretty soon you can see an infinite amount of image. If you have our bathroom mirror has a mirror on the, we have the bathroom mirror, and then we have a mirror on the back wall. And if you do the door properly, all of a sudden there's 72 of you. Actually, there's an infinite amount of you, you know. 72 is all, pretty soon they become smaller. So all of a sudden you see many more things that are not actually there. There's actually only one thing there, or two things, but really one thing. But now you see many things. We went through this last thing. We're good. See last week's talk or 2 weeks ago talk about yantras and stuff. But so that's also interesting. So anyway, he's actually beautiful. Actually, he's actually crystal. His real color is he's without color. Actually, so we say his shape. he holds a trisho, he has jata, he's like that. But what's his shape? He has no shape, he has no form. Right? We, you know, it's just so. So a Shivalingam is a shape that's no shape. It's a shape that represents a shapeless, right? So similarly, so anyway, jata daraya. So where is it? For the compassion bearer, Jasmine. Kapura kunda devalindu jata daraya daridya dukkha. You hold, you bear the moon. Of course, we know Shiva, the classic symbol, is Shiva has a moon in his hair. Right, in his jata daraya, in he holds jata, his dreadlock, and in his dreadlock he holds the moon. And I think last week or 2 weeks ago we told about the phases of the moon, 2 weeks ago I think, and how he now holds the moon, and how the Mahamudra Jayamanta came to place, and like this, right? And this is also, I mean, that's a story form of it. There's deeper or different ways of looking at yogic ways. The moon actually that he has on his forehead. We also have moons in our forehead. There's internal chakras as per yoga tradition. And the jata, of course, Shiva's hair, jata is a sign. I used to have it in here somewhere. It's gone now. if you still want to see my jata, I have it in the bag in my kutir, ready to go to India. You're looking for if you wonder where all my tapasya went, it's in a Ziploc bag in my kutir. I have to feel it a little bit, you know. So it's a sign of austerity, right? Yogis, the dreadlocks, we call them dreadlocks now, and the jata is a sign of bathing in many rivers. Actually, in the Bhagavatam, whenever a yogi leaves, like a king leaves the kingdom and goes for tapasya, then it says, and his hair matted, right, by bathing in many rivers. If you're not combing your hair and you're bathing in rivers full of sand, and you know, like your hair will naturally take on this form. Lord, we can dread our hair, right? Is the way we usually start it this way. You probably also started it this way, right? Even Lord Ram did this. He did it when he went. He had to take on the rupa and the lifestyle of an ascetic when he was exiled, right? He says, "Why are they exiled? He has to live as an ascetic in the forest. He's not an ascetic. He's a king or a prince, right? But he had to live like an ascetic." Right, which means he had to have jata, but he could have just bathed in many rivers in 12 years and slowly his hair would have been knotted, but it said he took sap from the Bibla tree, I believe, according to his, Chandradashi told us it's from the Bibla, they use it from the bell tree itself, the sap from there, and that's how they originally would mat their hair to start with, you know. But anyways, the symbol, so Shiva's jata is a sign that he's an ascetic, and it's a sign of not caring about your looks. Of course, we spend a lot of money on our jata. Turns out it's a lot of work to look like you don't care about your hair. That's the way it works. But anyways, and also the way you tell somebody's ascetic life sometimes is a very long jata means many years of tapasya. You know, so Shiva has very long jata. He has many years of tapasya, thousands, billions of years of tapasya. But also there's another story. He also within his hair, he doesn't have the moon. He also has the Ganga. When the Ganga descends, he catches it in his hair. It says that when the Ganga was descended to earth, nothing, what could hold it? Her descent from heaven would have destroyed the world. It had to be caught in something. So it's caught in his hair. And the hair, if you follow the Ganga up to Gangotri, you realize those windy roads, right, to Gangotri and Deb Prayag and Rudra Prayag and all the way up to Gangotri and like this. This is the jata. This is also his jata. Mm-hmm. This is the Himalayan mountains are the matted hair of Shiva. They're the one that catch it, and slowly as it wanes its way down through the hair, through the ridges and valleys, and then eventually hits safely the Hadwar and the plains and brings nourishment to the world in India. So the jata dharaya, he holds the moon in his coiled jata. Daridya Dukkha Dhanaya Namah Shivaya. And the destroyer of the suffering, Daridya Dukkha Dhanaya. Dahana, he destroys the dukkha of the daridra, means the suffering of those who are, I can't say suffering, that's not the right word. Suffering of the suffering. Daridya means of like, I've translated it as wretched, but not as like you're a wretched person. Like, yeah, I mean people who are, it's a description, not an accusation, right? Those who are suffering, those who are poor, who are diseased, who are, you know, the those who are just really by their status are suffering, you know. So he destroys the suffering of those who are diseased and in poverty. That's a way of saying it. Nama Shivaya. To that Shiva we bow. So when we say Om Namah Shivaya, which Shiva do you mean? We mean the one that's in union with Shakti, right? Who holds the moon in his hair, who helps us cross the ocean of suffering, who's an ocean of compassion, right? And destroys the suffering of those who are wretched. That's Maneshwar Shiva. So with the worship of Maneshwar, so the thing is, you can worship all the deities you worship in Maneshwar, including the main deity. But the rule is, before worshiping the main deity, here Kali, right, you have to worship again Maneshwar. So we're doing the puja to the Banalingam, the Maneshwar Shiva, right? But we also have to worship Bana as Bana, right? You know, that makes sense. You know, it's like you have to worship not just through the Shivalingam, you have to worship Maneshwar himself. It's one of the rules, right? That he has to be worshipped separately and given proper place. Maneshwar Mahadev. So, that was pretty good. Quick. Next. So here in our puja, let's see what we do in a daily puja here, in a small puja. Any questions about this so far? Devata puja. So here in the small book we get to Ramakrishna, worship of Ramakrishna, worship of Sri Sharada Devi. Right. So worship of Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother, because this is our tradition. Right. Actually, our puja is a little bit of a combination. Some of the main mantras and procedures, you can see this is coming from the Ramakrishna Mission puja book. And that was originally developed. Who was the Tantric and Thakura's disciples? His father was Sharadananda, maybe Sharadananda or Shivananda. I'm forgetting just now. His father was a Tantric pujari, right? And I think maybe Shivananda. And his father was a very expert at this Bengali forms of tantra, tantric worship. And so taking already the established forms of tantric puja, of Devi puja and like that, he adjusted it to worship of Sri Ramakrishna. Then Swami Ramakrishnananda in South India, he himself was a pujari. He comes from a family of Brahmin pujaris, not just Brahmins, a lot of them are from pujaris, and highly ritualistic. And in South India, when he was in South India, he was developing his own, roughly the same. Of course, South India, they have their own style, but he was doing Bengali puja, but slightly different. Right? So over the years, there's been some attempt to bring Swami Ramakrishnananda's version of puja and Shivananda's father, if I'm getting that right, version of puja together. Right, so they've been, the new version of the book have some adjustments. We've also made some of those adjustments in our book, right? But they're not. We're not just getting from that. They're the classic manuals, medieval manuals, and things like that for Kali Puja in Bengal. They have all these points, but they cleaned up a little bit and organized a little bit to make a little sense. So we're following up to this point in a certain sense. We're following almost probably 80% with Ramakrishna Mission book. On Ramakrishna puja is there after the worship of Ramakrishna, but it peak for them was the worship of Sri Ramakrishna, worship of Holy Mother Swami Vivekananda, right? So we do this as one of the preliminary worships because our puja is worshiping Kali, right? But of course Ramakrishna and Kali are not different. But so there's also a dhyan mantra. So some dhyan mantras, usually a dhyan mantra describes the form that's seen, not just like describing like the iconographic form of the deity. It's the iconographic form of the deity seen by rishis, right? So I can write something, oh, we worship Kali who has a sword in his hand, and this, I can describe her, and then you can write it down, the dhyan mantra. But to be a real mantra has to be from a realized rishi, not just somebody composing some description. It should be a rishi. So this mantra also comes from a rishi. Right, somebody who had a vision of Sri Ramakrishna. Right now, because maybe one of you maybe had a vision of Sri Ramakrishna and can write down what you saw. Right, and maybe you're the rishi of that mantra. Right, but Sri Ramakrishna was not that long ago, and the people who composed this puja knew him. Their vision of Sri Ramakrishna was their daily life with him. Right. So their description is this is their own, like me describing Atmaram. You know, I'm the Rishi. I've had a mystical vision. I've seen Atmaram. You know, right? It's like, but actually, it is a mystical vision, right? It's not like we say, you've seen with open eye a mystical vision. Somebody you see something totally spiritual. It's a mystical vision. It's not physically there, right? This is like a spiritual reality you see, right? Sri Ramakrishna's body was like that. His incarnation was like that. It's the same as it's 1,000 visionary experiences in one moment. He's in human flesh, not just an image in the mind that appears in the consciousness. Your consciousness takes on that form for the time being. You see some wonderful thing inside, right? The wonderful thing they saw inside stayed outside and talked to them and told them what to do. And, you know, like this is the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna are the rishis of Ramakrishna's mantras, right? And so the one who wrote this Dhyan Sloka for Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Abhedananda, who is Sri Ramakrishna's direct disciple, Kali Maharaj, Kalipada Ghosh, I think is maybe his pre-monastic name. Kali Maharaj. And he was a great tapasvi. He came to the West also. I think he spent many, many years in the Western world. Founded New York, the first New York Center of Nantasai, New York, very important. I think he crossed the ocean so many times. Really went into Mexico, into Canada. He did so much. A tremendous personality, and he was a great ascetic. During his years of wandering, many of the disciples of Ramakrishna, after the passing of the master, did much wandering. He also did tremendous austerity wandering. He's out of all Thakur's disciples, he's the one you imagine. He was wandering with Jatta. His hair matted from bathing in many rivers, right? And a copan, a blanket. He only had a picture of Sri Ramakrishna. You know, he did tremendous austerity like that. But then Swami called him back. Swamiji called him back and sent him to the West for preaching. Right? He spoke very good English, had incredible knowledge of philosophy, Western philosophy, very learned, educated like that, as well as a realized soul. And so he wrote many hymns. The hymn we use for Sri Ramakrishna, he wrote. The hymn we use for Holy Mother, also the Dhyan Mantra for Holy Mother, he also wrote, right? But these verses actually don't describe his form. Usually you think, a Dhyan Mantra, here's Sri Ramakrishna, right? So how do you mean? He's sitting in a comfortable posture, his hands like this, his eyes half closed, right? Smiling sweetly. Right, you know, dressed with one cloth draped around his shoulders. That's how you describe him like this. But of course, we don't need a Dhyan Mantra for Sri Ramakrishna. We have his photograph, right? So his description is not his physical description. It's his spiritual description. Very interesting, right? He went deeper. And it's from a long hymn. I don't think that might... It's not a pink book there, Ramakrishna hymns, is there? Hardback pink book. Is it there? No, maybe not.
It's a blue one.
No, the pink, it's pink hardback. No, it's not there, I don't think. It's, you know that Jaya Jaya He, Keshava Dhrita Narahari Rupa Jaya Jagadishare, the Das Avatar Stotam, we get the Nrisingadev Mantra from that, by Jayadev Goswami. He describes, it's praising, it's a precursor to the praise of Lord, to the life of Radha and Krishna, the love life of Radha and Krishna, called the Gita Govind. In the precursor to the Gita Govinda, he does this hymn to the 10 avatars of Krishna. Each one from the classical 10, and maybe even formed the classical 10 in their finalized form of, what is it, Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narasingha, Vamana, who's missing, Parashuram, Rama, Krishna, and Buddha, and Kalki, right, the 10, right? So, but actually, each one he describes that form, and then he says, Keshava Dhrita Narahari Rupam Jaya Jagadishare. Keshava Dhrita Meena Sharira, Keshava Dhrita Buddha Sharira. We worship Keshava, Lord Krishna, with beautiful long hair, right? Then Lord Keshava, we worship Keshava in the form of Buddha, in the form of a tortoise, in the form of a boar, in the form of a man lion, right? So, it's actually seeing all these incarnations of the past to be really just forms of Krishna, right? So in this hymn of Abhedananda, Swami Abhedananda, he does the same thing. It's the Ramakrishna version of the Dashavatar Stotram, right? Where each of the avatars, he said, It ends with Vimala Paramahansam Rama Krishnam Bhajamaha. Right? That Rama Krishna Paramahansa, that supreme awakened swan Sri Ramakrishna, in that form, in the form of the avatars, Bhajamaha, I worship. Right? But Sri Ramakrishna is in the Dashavatar Stotram, it's a Vaishnava text, right? And therefore it's showing the classical 10 forms of Vishnu as worshipped at the time and popularized at the time, being forms of Krishna. With Sri Ramakrishna avatar, he was not just a Vaishnava. He was also a Shakta. He was also a Christian. He was also a Buddhist. He was also a Muslim. He was everything, right? And therefore the conception of him as of who he is or what he was is the one, not just the one who came as Korma and Varaha and Nrisingadev, but also the one who came as Jesus, as Muhammad, as Buddha, as Mahavir, right? So it's the beautiful mantras are given. There's a Dhyan Slokam for Buddha, the Dhyan Slokam for Jesus, Dhyan Slokam for Muhammad, for Shankaracharya, for Chaitanya Dev, right? Each one ends with Keshava Dhrita Narahari Rupa. So in the puja, we use three mantras. One is the first of the text, and the last two are the last two of the text, right? In between is all the different avatars and prophets and incarnations and saviors as conceptualized, right? But this is also very nice how it's set up. These three slokas don't describe his form, describe who his identity. And it describes his identity in an interesting way. The first, I have to make sure to get this right because I'm not looking at the text, I'm trying to do a little bit from memory so I don't slow myself down. The first verse describes him as Nirgun God, as God without, Nirakar or Nirgun, beyond qualities, right? With beyond name, beyond form, beyond gunas, right? Is as a Nirgun Nirakar Brahman, right? The second mantra describes him as Sagun Brahman, as Brahman with qualities, with attributes, right? And the third mantra as incarnated Brahman, as avatar. So it's interesting how these three mantras, it as a Dhyan Sloka, this leaves all Dhyan Slokas in the dust. It's not just he sits like this. He describes Holy Mother like this. He has beautiful hair, you know, her mood like this. But for Sri Ramakrishna, he's describing something very, that he's the absolute God, he's the conceptualized God, and he's the incarnate God. Not only the one that's come in all the other incarnation, all other prophets like this. He's identified like this. The one that everyone worships, the one that everyone follows, is also came is Ramakrishna. But let's go into his details. Hridaya kamalam madhye rajitam nirvikalpam. Hridaya kamalamadye rajitam nirvikalpam. Rajitam nirvikalpa. He is nirvikalpa. Right? We have the word nirvikalpa samadhi. Nirvikalpa without movement, without vibration. Right? Without manifest, without vikalpas. so he's the changeless absolute. That's how we've translated it, right? The nirvikalpam, the one that's changeless beyond any manifest, beyond any vibration, beyond any conception, changeless, right? Hridaya kamala madhye. Hridaya kamala madhye. Madhye in the middle, kamala, lotus, hridaya, heart. In the center of the lotus of the heart, we meditate upon, who are we meditating? Actually, in the tradition, you meditate upon the deity, you visualize the deity in your heart. So if you visualize, we sit there, visualize Sri Ramakrishna in the heart, lotus heart. Who is it that we're meditating on in the heart? He's a changeless, Rajit Anirvikalpam, he is the changeless absolute. Sar asar akila biratitam. He is sar asar akila biratitam. He is beyond any grasp of any duality. Sar asat, like existence, non-existence. Even these ideas of existence and non-existence, he's beyond these ideas. Existence and non-existence, we think, oh, we have existence, and that's like you can't get more absolute than existence. Yes, you can. Existence is an idea that we superimpose upon something we don't know, right? We have a word for it. So existence is, he's beyond even the idea of existence and non-existence, or truth and falsehood, real, unreal, sad, asad, pure, impure, devoted, demonic. Sad, asad has all these meanings, right? Akila is, he's inconceivable, beratitam, and beyond any idea of duality. even the duality of existence, non-existence, that conception he's beyond. Ekam Swarupam, his real Swarupa, his real nature, is one unitary, one alone without a second. He's the absolute, the one truth. Pakriti Vikriti Shunyam. Pakriti Vikriti. Pakriti means the manifestations of nature. Pakriti Vikriti means that all the manifestations of Pakriti, right? He's Vikriti Shunyam. He's devoid of that, right? Within his essential nature, there is no Pakriti. There is no manifestation. There is no movement. Pakriti is that which is always moving. That's what it means, right? Right. The nature itself is always in movement. But actually, within him, this is beyond duality or beyond nature, beyond nature's manifestation. Only the unitary being. Nityam Anandam Murtim. So if he has a form, what's his murti? Is Nityam Anandam. He's eternal, eternally blissful. Or blissful, I don't know. Nityam Anandam. He's eternally in bliss. Blissful consciousness, right? Vimala Paramahansam, Ram Krishna. To that, Paramahansam, that supreme swan, supremely awakened being, Paramahansam Ramakrishna, Bhajamaha, I worship, and we meditate upon, we adore, right? And also this Paramahansa, Paramahansa means supreme swan, but Paramahansa is a description. He is not a Paramahansa. We say Ramakrishna Paramahansa, because what type of sadhu was Ramakrishna? Like we could say, oh, he's a supreme sannyasi. Who is more detached than Sri Ramakrishna, right? Was he a sannyasi? Right, he had a wife. He wore leather slippers. He slept on a bed, on a high bed with mosquito curtains. Believe it or not, that's sannyasis. He's not supposed to have any of these things. In case you're wondering, nowadays sannyasis can do almost anything. But back in the day, even 100 years ago, that was considered scandal. He's not a regular sannyasi, right? So the description in the tradition of sannyas, there's Hamsa sannyasis, there's Paramahansa sannyasis, there's the Kurcha sannyasis, Hamsa sannyasis, Paramahansa sannyasis, and Avahuta sannyasis. Kurcha means like a brahmachari. This is people who are living still within, living ascetic, disciplined life within structures of the world, often living at home or living in an ashram like that. Hamsa sannyasi, this is ones who carry a danda and orange cloth. And this, when we think of a sannyasi, we usually think of, he's Swamiji. But it means Hamsa sannyasi, right? And the Hamsa means swan, and here Hamsa also means the self, right? It is all this dual language going on. But here Hamsa also means a swan, mythologically believed, if you mix water and milk together, it can drink the milk, right? So the sannyasi lives in the world in such a way where he only takes the spiritual and avoids the material. That's their conception. Paramahansa is one who, he may not follow any of the dress. He's so established in renunciation and devotion and divine consciousness, that whether he dresses in orange cloth and carries a stick and shaves his head or has long hair or uses shoes or doesn't use shoes or drives a car or doesn't drive a car. Right? So that's a Paramahansa, right? And so by calling him a Paramahansa, so we will say, the Paramahansa lives there. You can't say, there's a sadhu who lives there. What type of sadhu? They go to his room and he says, what type of sadhu is he? He doesn't look like a sadhu. Right, but if you say, a Paramahansa lives there. There's Paramahansas like that. That they're illumined beings or highly evolved beings, finally above ascetics also, but they have none of the external trappings. Then Avahuta is somebody who's so beyond that often they can't even wear clothes, they can't follow any social rules. What to speak of sannyas rule, they can't follow any social rule. They've transcended. There's other stages beyond, but this is by calling him Paramahansa, but also Paramahansa means the supreme self. There's a play. Hamsa means self. Paramahansa means supreme self. So it's also, he's the incarnation of that supreme self. Paramahansa is also, so it's a stage. He lived like a Paramahansa. He was God himself, we believe, right? But he lived like a Paramahansa. He was a sannyasi of a sort, but not he wasn't like a Swami, right? They don't call him Swami Ramakrishnananda Puri or something like that, or something. You know, it's a different thing. Ramakrishna Paramahansa, but also Paramahansa, he's somebody who's illumined, the highest self. So that's the first mantra, describing him as a Nirgun Brahman, Sagun Brahman, Nirupamati Shukshmam, incomparable. So it's interesting, by saying he's incomparable means he's something. Right? He's something so wonderful you can't compare him with anything else. It's still something. It's not inconceivable, incomparable. It's a very interesting Nirupamati Shukshmam. He's, why? Because he's Ati Shukshmam, very subtle. Right? This is the nature of Nirgun Brahman, right? Still, we start talking about God, but in very abstract forms. He has some quality but no form, or some, you know, he's the creator, or it's the creator, or creation. You know, these are very subtle points. Philosophers, this is the realm of theologians and philosophers, right? Ati Shukshmam, very subtle. He's the most subtle. So subtle, there's nothing he can be compared to. He's so unique. Nish prapancham niriham. Niriham. He, I've translated it as acosmic, means that within him there's no he's still one, he's not, there's no world yet, right? Acosmic and niriham, desireless, without desire. Gagana sadrisham. Gagana sadrisham, we have the same word, similar word in the Guru Gita. Means Gagana means he's like the sky. So also you say, oh, like something subtle, like the sky. Right? What do we call the sky? Because, you know, like air is something, it's almost invisible, we can feel it, they keep getting broader. It's something, space is something, right? The sky, emotionally, poetically, it's a sky. By scientifically, it's space. It's something, but it's almost nothing. It's so subtle, you can't hold it, you can't point to it. You can describe it, but not really. You can only abstract it, right? So he's like the sky. Gagana sadrisham, isham, sarvabhuta vinashanam. He is the Lord who's subtle like the sky. Sarvabhuta vivasham. That he means he's the home for all that in which all beings rest. Sarvabhuta, right? All beings, all bhuta, and also all elements, everything, all people, and all things, all elements, all gunas, everything rests in him. So he's not a thing. He's the one in which things exist. He's not a being. He's the reality in which beings exist, right? That's the idea. Sarvabhuta vinashanam, triguna rahitam, triguna rahita. Oh, I'm sorry, triguna rahita. Home of all beings, worship beings. He's beyond the three gunas. Beyond the pale of the three gunas. Triguna rahita satchit brahma rupam varenyam. Who do we meditate upon? The one who's satchit brahma rupam. Satchit ananda. He's existence, constant bliss. Brahma rupam. His essence is Brahman. Where he's also Brahman, but now the conceivable one. We're saying things about Brahman. The first mantra says, "He who can, nothing can be said about." Is there something he exists? He, all beings exist in him. He's subtler than the subtlest, greater than the greatest. Like that, Brahma Rupam Varenyam, that supreme swan, Sri Ramakrishna. We bow. Nirakara, Sakara Brahman, now avatar. Vitaritam, Vitaritum, avatirnam. Jnana Bhakti Prashantihi, Pranalaya Galichitam. Vitaritam, Vitaritam. He has been born, he's taken incarnation, his avatar, right? Out of the feeling, because his heart is full of compassion for the suffering of souls, of jivas, right? Of the soul, of the, seeing the suffering of people's spiritual, what's the cause of suffering is ignorance, seeing people in ignorance. Right, out of compassion, he's taken a human. That same non-dual reality, and now the manifest reality has now has taken an incarnation in a human body, seeming human body, because of his love and compassion. Cannot bear to see the suffering of beings in this world suffering. Right, pranagilit jnana bhakti prashantim. He has taken birth. Why? To give bhakti, jnana bhakti, and bhakti. Prashantihi, and jnana, knowledge, wisdom, liberating knowledge, bhakti, devotion, and prashantihi, real peace, right? Not only that we want peace in every aspect. We want peace politically, we want peace socially, we want peace in our life, but actually the real, we're being fried in a, if you're on a frying pan, And the Holy Mother Mantra describes her like this. The souls are frying in this world, right? Suffering and our ignorance like that. We want, that's not way to have peace. We have to be, jnana and bhakti gives peace, right? Jnana bhakti prashanti pranagalita chittam jiva dukkha sashnam. In order to, out of the suffering for human beings, he's taken birth. Dritta sahaja samadhim. Now let's describe him, now describe why he's born. Now let's say something about his incarnation. The reason he's born, to give jnana, bhakti, and shanti, right, to the suffering souls in this world, right? Because his he cannot bear to see their suffering. But now, what is he like? Dritta sahaja samadhim, chinmayam komalangam. His mind is always sahaja samadhim. His mind is naturally, all the time, just in samadhi. Right? Yudli is described as in between. It's the sahaja state, in between samadhi, the relative and the absolute. His mind always naturally dwelt who he was. Like you said, our problem, I don't know about you, I don't want to superimpose my problems on you, but my problem is my mind's not habitually in samadhi. Right, we're habitually in a relative state of physical. We struggle like anything. Hopefully, one day, by God's grace, by our sadhana, by the grace of, by the kirtan, we doing everything we can to get a little taste of something spiritual, a higher taste, a higher realization, right? And then there's some souls that the minds dwell all the time in bliss, right? These are the avadhuts, right? And the trigunatita, they're you can't bring them down, right? Those of us who are struggling, trying to look up occasionally beyond the material world and our own attachment to it and conditioning by it, we look up towards the spiritual. We're sadhaks, okay, that's good, right? But that's not, that doesn't have any real purpose. An avatar who's stuck in the material world has no value, right? Somebody, an avatar who's lost in bliss also has not much value, right? His mind was habitually, naturally, sahaja, naturally, just at the state of samadhi, what technically in the Ramakrishna tradition they call Bhava Mukh, right? He actually said the divine, three or four visions came to him where sages appeared to him, where the divine mother said, where like different things, stay in Bhava Mukh. Bhava Mukh, it's hard to, we ourselves don't know what Bhava Mukh means. Even great scholars of the Ramakrishna tradition have commented on it, what it would actually mean, but it's probably understood to be something in between the mind. At that place where you can see the world, you can see the problems of the world, and you don't lose the bliss of God, right? And you see, if you're lost in the bliss of God, you don't see the problems of the world, right? What type of guru is, if doesn't see, if a guru doesn't see your ignorance, it doesn't give you knowledge, right? Swami Brahmananda, he would, somebody come with a problem to Swami Brahmananda, and he says, come back in a few days. And a few days, they, what was the problem you told? And he goes, yes, and then he give the answer to the problem. Because his mind was so all the time in samadhi, in a higher state, where these the things people would bring to him, the problem, these real problems, for us would be these life gripping problems, would be like nothing. You know, he didn't see the reality of it. Let his mind come down a little bit, and then he said, oh, what's your problem? Oh my God, I'm very sorry. You have to do this, or stop doing that, or you know, give some correction, initiation, some knowledge. But if your mind's in bliss, you don't see anything. And if your mind's in the world, what the use of asking such a person advice? There's lots of people giving advice whose minds are habitually in the material plane, right? Maybe have their mind thinking of God, but not lost in God. So Sri Ramakrishna Sahaja Samadhi, he's naturally, he can see this world and the problem of this world and the suffering in this world, but he also sees the absolute world. He gave this example also in a garden, there's a fence, and people hear some noise, some laughter at the outside of the fence. So one man puts a ladder and climbs up the fence and looks and goes, ah, ha, ha, and falls, jumps in. And somebody else sees what, and climbs up and he says, ah, bah, and he falls in. Right? Another one comes up and says, ah, and he turns around, everybody, come, something incredible over here. Right, that's this mantra is describing that state of the avatar. He sees the bliss of Brahman, but he also turns back and says, everybody come. Right? And that's actually the description of Sri Ramakrishna's his description of the avatar. He describes the avatar as like a window or a door in a room. So we're stuck in this room. Not all of us stuck. We're in this room, right? Let's say we're stuck in this room. Some of us are more stuck in this room than others. And you have the infinite outside this room is the infinite outside of this room, right? And so you have this story. You can hit on your hand and you can put it in the... You can put it right there for now. Thank you. Right? So how do we know about the infinite outside? Right? If there's a window or a door... Right, that door, it's a very unique thing. The door, if there's an open space between the inside and the outside, is it the outside or the inside? Right, a door or a window or a space, it's both inside that room and outside the room. It's both the limited, it's the way, you know, it's like, and if you didn't know, you'd think, oh, it's just like there's all these paintings, there's also a painting that looks like a door there. You wouldn't know that door is the outside. For all intended purpose, a space, a hole, a window, a door, and a wall is the outside. It's the infinite outside, because it's right in between the inside and the outside. It is the outside. It is the infinite space of outside touching the limitations of the inside. That's called a door or a space. Or so Thakur said, the avatar is like a hole in a wall by which you can see the infinite outside, right? So it's that exact state. He lived in that space. He didn't just embody, he literally lived that space. Your hallowed form is a pure Chinmayam Kumalangam. Your form, your divine form, is made actually not of a human body. Your human body is made of the radiance of intelligence. Chinmayam Kumalangam. You're habitually naturally on the verge between the relative and the absolute, and habitually go into samadhi. Your body is, your form is actually made of consciousness, radiant consciousness. Vimala Paramahansam Ramakrishnam, to that Supreme Swan Sri Ramakrishna, we bow. So this is quite a dhyan mantra. Describe Sri Ramakrishna as Nirgun Brahman, Sagun Brahman, and as Avatar. Right? These three mantras, very beautiful. And then we do the same five item worship. We offer incense, perfume, flower, leaves, incense, light, food, water, the normal way we do puja. And then the last few mantras here, we'll end with Sri Ramakrishna. I think we can do it. Now, with Sri Ramakrishna, along with Sri Ramakrishna, because Sri Ramakrishna is not alone. Of course, if he has a body, he has limbs. And if he has an incarnation, he has limbs, he has associates. So Anga is both his limbs as well as his associates, right? So we worship, we say, Eta Ganda Pushpe, Sri Ram Krishna Saranga Devata Bhyo Namaha. We worship the six limbs. The six limbs are usually considered his body, right? Anga, and then Sarvat and Etaganda Pushpe. What's the other? Avarna Devata Bhyo Namaha. His attendant deity. These are his disciples, the different souls that came with him. And then we worship also Holy Mother, Etaganda Pushpe, Om Aim Hrim Sarva Devi Devi Srupanye. And then Vivekanandari Sri Ramakrishna Parashadipatabhyana. We worship the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. And we say Vivekanandari because the foremost of them is Swami Vivekananda. So we start with beginning with Vivekananda and his other disciples. In elaborate pujas, we go Vivekanandaya Namaha, Brahmanandaya Namaha, Sharananandaya Namaha, Ramakrishnanandaya. We go through the different disciples of Sri Ramakrishna as a group. Parashadevata Vyonamaha, Vivekananda Sri Ramakrishna Parashadevata Vyonamaha. His Mula Mantra is also important. Om Aim, remember that same Bhak Bija, because he's worshipped as Guru Tattva here, as bringing knowledge, wisdom, refinement, education, mantra. Saraswati's vehicle is Aim, right? Sarva Deva Devi Sarupaya, whose form, he is the embodiment of Sarvadeva Devi, of all gods and all goddesses. So this is actually the tradition of Guru Puja. We think sometimes in the Guru, we think like this. Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Deva, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, we worship as Guru. But Sri Ramakrishna is not a normal Guru. He's literally all gods and goddesses. Right? The hymn that the Advaita Nanda wrote, describing him as all these gods, all rishis, all avatars. There's a beautiful book we've been reading called Ramakrishna Sarva Deva Devi Surupaya. It goes Ramakrishna as Radha, Ramakrishna as Krishna, Ramakrishna as Rama, Ramakrishna as Hanuman, Ramakrishna as you know, going through each one of them, how he manifested. Swami Chaitanya has a beautiful article in one of his books, Bahirupa Ramakrishna, Ramakrishna's many forms, the different forms he revealed himself in, visionary forms or open-eyed visions to people, different forms to gods and goddesses. So we worship in Sri Ramakrishna, we worship all gods, all goddesses. Sarva Devi Devi Sri Ramakrishna Namaha. And then Pranam Mantra is written by Swami Vivekananda. Again, can't get higher rishi of Sri Ramakrishna than Sri Ramakrishna Vivekananda. It's attached to the Kandana, his Arati hymn. Maybe we played it. We usually play it before Arati every night. It's very beautiful. We'll go through it one day. It's a very divine hymn written in Sanskritized Bengali. But at the then there's another hymn called the Om Hrimritam. This is the Arati hymn in pure Sanskrit, and this is the final mantra of that we use as the general dhyan, the pranam mantra Sri Ramakrishna. I think he wrote it in Lucknow, I believe, as the tradition goes. Om Stapakaya Chadharmasya Stapaka. He is the establisher of dharma. He is the one who came to this world. Why did he take incarnation? To establish dharma. That, of course, Krishna says, in every age, I'm born to establish dharma. He came like Krishna. He's the same response, I came to establish dharma. Sarva dharma surupine. And he is the embodiment of sarva dharma. He came to establish religion, and he is the embodiment of all religions. He is the proof of all religions. Sarva dharma surupine. Avatara Varishtaya, and he's the greatest of the avatars. Now, Swami Vivekananda was not one to exaggerated praise of guru cultism. All of the thinkers, even the Guru Gita says, my guru is the greatest guru, my God is the greatest God, my soul is the soul of everything, you know. There's a mantra like that. Everybody thinks their guru is greatest, their God is the greatest. It's not that. Swami Vivekananda hated such talk. And every time when it would happen even around Sri Ramakrishna, he'd smash it. He didn't like this type of talk. So when he said that Ramakrishna is avatara varishtaya, it means something more than just my guru is greatest. Right? He means something, actually. This is another hour talk we can give on avatara varishtaya. There's a beautiful YouTube talk, Swami Sridharananda, from the Vedanta Society of in Australia, that he talks about 2 hours just on what this avatara varishtaya means. So you can look at that to really get a good meditation on it. But it's not that he's the greatest avatar, right? But he's done something that no avatar has done, right? Avatar, Krishna says, when dharma declines and adharma rises, right? That we know, God, we believe that's one of the things the avatar does. He comes to save religion and like that. And he also, what he says, to establish dharma, to destroy adharma, and to protect destroy the wicked and protect the devoted, to destroy the demons, right, the wicked, right? So Sri Ramakrishna, so Rama came and we saw he killed Ravana and so many demons in Dandaka forest, right? Narasimhadev came and he killed wicked Hiranyakashipu. Krishna came and killed Kamsa and Charuna and so many others, and whole armies were killed by his arrangements, right? Ramakrishna came, he didn't kill anybody. As far as we know, Sri Ramakrishna didn't kill anybody, and he didn't have weapons, right? So it's interesting. What were Sri Ramakrishna's weapons? Who, if he came to establish dharma, destroy adharma, protect the devotees, and destroy the wicked, did he do any of these things really? Did he? Which wicked person did he destroy? So Swami Vivekananda gives hints of this. Actually, the greatest evil is not an external. We may have. I don't want to get political, but there may be great demons manifesting in the world even now, right? Shouting on camera, right? Whatever that is, right? These aren't the real demons. In the ancient world, that's how we conceptualize demons, right? But now there's deeper demons, right? And in Kali Yuga, he's Kali Yuga avatar, we say, right? Why? What's the demon of Kali Yuga, right? The real demon of Kali Yuga in spiritual life is doubt, materialism, lack of faith. We've lost our sense of the sacred also. So even if we believe in religion, we don't have any real, we've lost, we even know what that means, right? It's like Swami Vivekananda said he killed the demon of doubt, right? And so what are his weapons? His weapons were his songs, his words, katamrita, his nectar-like words, not a sword, not a shield, not a bomb, not an army, chariot, led by a chariot with four horses or whatever, you know. It's like his and sound divine arguments, not philosophical arguments, just statements of spiritual truth, his ecstatic visions, his illumined disciples, right? You know, what in the world of conflicting in the Sattva Dharma, when the religions are fighting with each other, right? What does his disciples do? Very interesting, like, you know, like if we be a little bit analytical, when the Christian missionaries came to India, a big message of the Christian missionaries in India is that your religion is, I mean, clearly that's general of any missionary, your religion's wrong, right? That's the first thing we should understand, your religion's wrong. Not only wrong, it's the reason you're suffering is because your religion is wrong. And the reason we've taken over is because your religion is wrong. I know, I'm finishing just now, Usha. I have 1 minute still, Usha. I'm taking my last minute, right? But when Sri Ramakrishna's disciples, they became missionaries and spread Ramakrishna's message all over the world, what did they say? Your religion is right. Your religion is true, right? Your religion is divine, right? If you follow it, you realize God. We know it because our master realized God following. He showed the proof of all this, right? Very interesting. His weapons were different. His arguments were different. And the enemy was different. It was not just a political foe of a great moral evil in the world, right? It was and of course the battle is still going on for the heart and soul of Kali Yuga world, you know. But anyway, we'll leave it there because now my 1 minute is now over. Next week next week is Navaratri. We'll probably talk on Devi, probably from the Chandi, most likely. And the following week we'll continue on the worship of Holy Mother, so on Vivekananda. And then finally, maybe one of these days, we'll start Kali Puja. We've done 16 talks. We haven't mentioned Kali yet, so we'll eventually get to Kali Puja. It's okay. We did 500 talks on the Bhagavatam, never mentioned Krishna. So we're right on schedule. Thank you for your kind attention. Hari Om Tat Sat. Arati Kaho. Remember the system? Okay. Come on, you want to do Arati?
Did we make it pretty?
Yeah.